So thank you all so much for coming. It's a great honor to be here. Thank you for having me as your moderator. How this is going to work is we're going to speak for about half an hour, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. And I believe Kate and Cade will have microphones. So at that point, you can just raise your hand, and they'll run over and hand you the microphone. My name's Chad Liebel. I'm a graduate student, well, I was a graduate student from the MFA program here 2 years ago, and a former fellow, Cabell First Novelist Fellow. Henry Dunow is has been agencying since the early 80s, has founded his own agency in 1997, which has since evolved into Dunow Carlson and Lerner Literary Agency. He works primarily with quality fiction and voice-driven nonfiction. And you're also an author of the book The Way Home, which is a memoir about fatherhood. And some of your clients are Gene Thompson, Amy Bender, Elizabeth McCracken, and of course, Boris Fishman here joining us tonight. So I'd like to start from the very beginning when this book was just an idea and sort of go through a little timeline of how it came to fruition and the publication and how you two met, because actually you told me you might have an interesting story of how you met, I think in an email.
Right.
Not to put too much pressure on you.
No, no. Well,
this is why he's here.
Yeah. Well, before I go into the origins of our association, I just want to congratulate you personally, Boris. Working with you and working with this magnificent novel and the work that's followed has been just tremendous, and it's really gratifying that you've won this award and that A Replacement Life has gotten such accolades since its first publication.
It's really
gratifying.
Thank you.
The publishing industry sees a lot of really terrific novels sail by without a great deal of notice. So it's been really satisfying to see this have the kind of ride that it has had. So congratulations.
Thank you. Henry would bat this away, but there's not a little that he's had to do with that outcome, but we'll save that for later in the conversation.
So you asked me how we got to know each other. Boris approached me through an email, and I don't think I've shared this with you, but I knew a bit about you, Boris, before I
heard about you. It sounds like it wasn't good.
And no, it was all good. In fact, you know that I represented a former girlfriend.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
And you...
There's nothing quite like ending up with the same agent as your ex-girlfriend.
Well, you invoked her
separate
name
panel on that.
In that introductory email and wondered if I might have remembered hearing your name. Well, what an understatement that was, because I had heard so much about you, in fact. Alana often went on about her brilliant writer boyfriend who... worked for The New Yorker and was publishing journalism here and there and everywhere. So I confess I was actually quite intimidated to be in touch with you at first and very flattered to be on the list of agents that you were approaching. You wrote a very good letter. It was very succinct in describing the novel, which is a virtue that I admire, that works for me. You reduced it, in fact, to a single sentence that spoke to me immediately, because it was a way of describing the novel that just was going to stick in my brain. I think you said as much in the first sentence you said about the novel tonight, which is it's about a young man, a struggling writer, cajoled and then coerced by his very persuasive grandfather into writing, forging Holocaust restitution claims for the old Jews back in the old neighborhood.
Yes.
And that premise just, I thought, yes, I can see the book that develops from that. You sent me the novel, and as history tells us, I turned you down.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
I've rewritten that history in my mind.
When was this, by the way? How many years ago?
December 2012.
Yeah. I actually have the letter here.
What, you don't remember the date, Henry?
I did a little research into our past, so I'll read some of the pertinent things. Do the words New Orleans bring up any memories?
Oh, I was hoping
you'd
bring that up. That's important to
talk about.
I said,
Boris, you are as talented and interesting a writer as I've come across in a good while. Some of A Replacement Life is just dazzling. Hence my excitement when I read the early pages. I think I'd written you a quick email after, after just a day or so. The writing is earthy, pungent, both quick and wonderfully complex. I sat up and took notice over and over again. Your characters are drawn with great precision and great heart, especially the bickering and tenderness and guile of the old Jews in Brooklyn. Ultimately, though, I don't think the novel fully succeeds, and I'd like to try to explain why I feel that. And then I went on for three or four detailed paragraphs, and I rarely go into this kind of detail when saying no to someone. And then it closed by saying, I wouldn't go into this kind of detail if I didn't think this could really be an extraordinary novel and a wonderful premise, terrific writing, vivid characters, but at least in my opinion, it needs a pretty major overhaul. I may be way off base with these comments. I don't know what kind of reactions you're getting from other readers, but if you'd like to discuss any of this, I'd welcome that conversation. And I'd also be interested in hearing about the other projects you alluded to. So I wasn't sure what was going to happen next.
Let me just take a second to explain what Henry's referring to. So before starting my novel, I, out of great anxiety, created not only a complete roadmap as to what it would be about, but it came up with like an extremely clever, elaborate parallel to anchor it. It would be not only about Holocaust restitution fraud in Brooklyn, it would also be about reparations fraud after Hurricanes Katrina in New Orleans. And so I'd have Jews behaving badly and African Americans behaving badly, the two taboos of our politically correct age. The problem was that the New Orleans part was just dead. I had done too much research. I'd spent, you know, a very dutiful amount of time down there. I'd gotten all the details right, but it had no life, precisely because I think it was over-concerned with getting the wallpaper right. And what Henry said to me, if I am rendering it correctly, was, I believe in you, and I believe in this book, but New Orleans has to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
And so I gained an agent and lost half my novel.
Wow.
Well, honestly, I will say this. So you came in, and we had a terrific meeting. You know, I think we just sensed a very nice fit in so many ways.
And I'd like to talk about why, too.
In terms of what was on the page, but also just in terms of our interests and sensibility and, to a certain extent, shared backgrounds and so forth. And I did not want to let this guy go. So you went, we talked the novel through pretty extensively, and you went off and thought about it. And I wasn't really sure what the decision was going to be. We might have had a couple more conversations or exchanges of emails and so forth. And then you came back and said, yes, I am willing to do this. And I took a flyer in a certain sense. And, I mean, I really wanted it to work out. So I said, yes, let's do this. Now, the many, many times I've sent a writer off to work on revisions of a manuscript, and I'll be expecting them to come back in maybe 3 or 4 months, and instead they come back in 2 weeks, and you have to search with a microscope to see where the changes have been. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, Boris just remade the novel very, very aggressively, very dramatically, and I think made it a much, much stronger book, so it worked out beautifully. But I can really count on one hand, in all the years I've been doing this, number of times I've said to a writer, well, I'll take another look if you revise it accordingly, and where it's ended up working out. But in this case, you really rolled up your sleeves and made it into the
and we kept we kept working. That wasn't the end. We did three new drafts together before Henry deemed it adequate for submission.
Well, at the point that I'd memorized most of the manuscript,
yeah.
I felt it was time to let it go.
But I should add that level of by the time that HarperCollins purchased it for publications, I don't know that they changed a single word. It had been so worked on initially by myself and then together with Henry that they got a product that they felt comfortable just sending into print.
Your editor was Terry Carton, correct?
Yes.
So afterward, there was not much back and forth with you and Terry. It was pretty much ready to go.
I mean, there was back and forth about, holy crap, I'm getting a novel published. There was a lot of just logistical stuff I wanted to learn about. But editorially, very little.
Wow. That is one thing that really surprised me when I started working in publishing was the editorial role that agents often take. And I was going to ask you, and then, how often do you do that? and if you give a lot of feedback and editorial advice.
I do. For me, that's the most interesting and challenging and rewarding part of the job. I like being as close to the creative inception as I possibly can.
That's important to flag because a lot of agents don't edit, and some writers prefer that. I think all writers can use an editor, and they can certainly use an editor before it gets in front of any editor at a publishing house, but a lot of agents don't edit. And I knew well enough to know that I really, really wanted someone to be interested in that in order to work with. That said, you strike a really beautiful balance in that you're deeply engaged in the macro without micromanaging my prose. And that particular balance is so valuable and important to me. I work so hard on my sentences. I'm sure Henry would flag it and we have talked about things down on the sentence level, and I'm sure you would flag something if it was really trying too hard or really failing, but it's really wonderful to have that left alone while a tremendous amount of close attention is given to the macro structure of the work. That balance was always the right balance for me. And also Henry's balance between the art of it and the business of it, because it really is both. And if you think about it differently, then good luck. It was really, really incredibly useful to have a guide that had one foot planted firmly in both of those sort of terrains. I couldn't have done well with a pure businessman, and I couldn't have done, well, I don't know if any agents or stargazers exclusively, but that particular balance was incredibly instructive and also reassuring, because I don't know that you get too many shots at having this thing sent out into the world. So having that kind of guidance was very valuable.
Oh, well, thank you.
I haven't said that to you before.
Yeah, well, that means an awful lot.
Nice opportunity to do so. But what inspired A Replacement Life, even going back further, before you started giving it to agents? And I'm not sure, you know, did you query a whole bunch of agents?
Or
did
you go and how many years in the making was this before you began showing it
to agents? Yeah, you got the cream on the top, Henry. It was grim beneath. My grandmother was a Holocaust survivor, and because the kid learns English the fastest in an immigrant family, I was given her restitution paperwork to fill out. And even at the, you know, tender age of 16 or 17, whatever I was struck by the fact that the application did not require any documentation. Why? Because so much was destroyed during the war by the Germans. A lot by the Soviets was never released. If you had something, please submit it. If you don't, you're not disqualified. And what was incredible about this was that it basically came down to a matter, this matter of history became a matter of storytelling. If you could tell a good story about what you went through during the war you were in. And in her case, it wasn't hard. I just took down what she went through, and even a little bit about it was more than enough. But I started thinking to myself, it's got to be only a matter of time before somebody in my community has a field day with these. Which I turned out to be more right about than I expected, because as it was revealed in 2010, I'd done a draft of the novel by then. But a whole bunch of people in South Brooklyn were doing exactly what I had ended up imagining in the novel. They'd been doing it since the early 90s and were finally caught in 2010 and sent to prison for it. They'd forged 5,000 applications.
Wow.
And they'd ended up getting caught only because they got lazy and started repeating the details, which is exactly why they get caught here, part of it at least. So that was the inspiration for it. I had an agent when I started working on the book. He and I had been sort of editorially missing each other for about 5 years by the time that I started working on it. So though it was a great disappointment, it was no surprise when I presented him with the first draft and he said, I just don't see it. At which point I finally stopped feeling guilty about parting ways and went off on my own, though that was terrifying because I proceeded to do quite a number of drafts alone. And after about six, I sent it out to about a half dozen agents, all of whom wrote back to say no. And not one of them proposed to take another look at it once I went back to the drawing board and made changes to it. And so from six to nine, again, I was on my own. And it was after the ninth draft that I finally had enough people.
Nine drafts, oh my God. Everybody hear that? Nine drafts.
And then three more with Henry.
Wow.
But I'd crossed some hump after I'd done nine. because I now sent it out to 15, and I got about a half dozen positive replies, among which was Henry. Now, I just want to tell you a very quick story about agenting, and I'm actually curious to hear your perspective on this. I've had a friend who was trying to decide between two agents, and he sent his manuscript around, and one of the two agents said, "I will not give you my feedback until you sign with me." And he reasonably said, "How could I possibly sign with you if I don't know what you think about my work?" And she just shrugged. Compare with that my conversation with Henry, where I went so far as to say, Henry, to which editors or which houses would you send this novel? And he just sent me a list without any anxiety about having it stolen or taken away for the benefit of another agent. And I thought to myself, what an incredible, what a reassuring and inspiring level of confidence. And that was only a part of what persuaded me. I've been talking a little bit about the rest of it, but I just loved that maneuver. Only somebody who knows what he's doing does not feel threatened by revealing that information. And so that was really cool and also very reassuring.
Yeah, that sort of transparency I think is crucial. I mean, why would you want to work with someone that's not going to be honest with you?
I spent 5 years with the wrong agent. We had the same ethnic background, or national background, I should say, and I thought that that would connect us literarily. But ethnic affinity is not the same as editorial affinity. And if you're trying to publish a novel, the latter is much more important than the former. And so I know from being mismatched. And one ought to be with the agent with whom one is going to soar the highest based on what one's strengths are.
Well, it is a key relationship in the publishing business. It's probably the key relationship that an author will have in her or his career, the traditional relationship between an author and an editor is no longer as stable and long-lasting as it might have been a generation or two ago, largely because of all the changes in corporate publishing that both make an editor's and also an author's longevity at a particular house much more precarious than it was at other times. So it is very important to make the right choice and to feel a certain comfort level with your agent. To hear your agent talk about your work in the way that you would yourself want to talk about your work, because ultimately that's the way he talks to you about your work is the way he'll be talking to editors or potential buyers for your work and, you know, helping create your profile in the literary business. So that level of, you know, common understanding and communication is really key.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I heard you speak earlier today on Virginia This Morning, and you were saying how this book was spiritually autobiographical. And I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate on that, because I know it's an annoying question when people say, was this you? And it turns out that you had written a restitution letter, but obviously not for an entire community. So spiritually, what was this for you? What was this sort of experience? And I imagine also that there was probably a sort of moral obligation here or a weight that you might have been feeling, because this is quite a, you know, personal topic to you and very close to your own experience.
Yeah, I mean, it helps that almost no one in my family can read English. Only my mother has read this novel. My father's English isn't strong enough. And interestingly enough, despite having sold in places like Brazil and Estonia, it still has not been bought in Russia.
Wow.
Which it's even been bought in Germany, and this is a tricky book for a German publisher to issue, but not in Russia. So it wasn't so much obligation as just the kind of fear of my mother, who quite vainly decided that the family in the novel was ours, and therefore everyone would assume the worst things about us. What will they think about us? But honestly, perhaps arrogantly, but I do believe a certain amount of healthy arrogance is very valuable for especially a first-time novelist. The only obligation I ultimately felt was, and I'm a pretty responsive and responsible and guilt-ready only son, but the only obligation I felt ultimately was to the book. Now, people do ask, how much of this is autobiographical? I've had said to me, if you tell me what really happened, I'll buy the book, which is a tricky. And of course, there's a young man in this trying to figure out his way through his 20s and figure out what art means and being an adult means and being a good son means. And of course, that was me. But of the two love interests, one is based on someone real and one is invented. Of the two elder men in the story, one is based on someone who exists and one is invented. And I invite you to decipher which is which, and I bet half this room will pick one and half will pick another. The issue is that even when you take from real life does not work as drama. They have completely different requirements. You cannot put a transcript of what really happened into a story. It'll fall flat. And so even the things that are taken from real life are completely warped and manipulated and distilled and have had all kinds of things done to them. So often, an entire set piece about buying graves, the graves the grandfather buys, I remember reading a New York Post item that was this big about a guy who had cornered the unofficial grave market at Washington Cemetery in Brooklyn. That was maybe 20 words, and I made a scene that was a chapter out of that. 95% of that is invented, but I guess the important kernel is factual. The other thing is that writing from autobiography, I think there's this assumption that it's easier because you've got the material ready. But I think it actually sometimes makes it harder because you're overly influenced by what really happened, and it becomes harder to imagine what else might have happened, which actually might work better fictionally. So sometimes you're better off working from a clean slate. So there was a lot more autobiography here at the beginning than there was at the end because I understood the freedom of inventing from scratch, and by then I'd had a little bit more confidence to try doing that. So there is and there isn't. So, you know, my second novel is about a family in New Jersey that adopts a boy from Montana who turns out to be feral. And it's written from the adoptive mother's perspective. And I don't have to tell you that I'm not a woman, nor a parent, nor an adoptive mother, nor any of that stuff. And my contention to you, which requires you to read the novels, is that the second one is far more autobiographical than the first.
Wow. Hey, I wanted to ask you about writing the second novel, which is coming out in under HarperCollins in the spring. It's called Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. And just from that title alone, I can tell it is a different novel than A Replacement Life.
Not to get superficial, but a part of it is superficial. Titles are important. Being able to summarize things in a sentence is important.
Did you change the title for A Replacement Life, or was it always that?
It was always A Replacement Life. I think the British editor on the novel wanted to rename it. I think she's such a wonderful, smart editor. But she really slipped up on the titles. I remember she wanted, like, Potatoes and Moonshine or something like that. I'm glad I stood my ground when that email came through.
Yeah. I thought I saw one that was translated that had the word Brooklyn in the title.
The German title is The Biographer of Brooklyn.
Okay. Right.
And we went back and forth about that quite a bit.
Yeah. Huh.
The German publisher insisted that that would be a more effective title.
While we're on this, the Estonians had a wonderful typo in their contract. Do you remember this? It said, "We would love to purchase a replacement wife for publication in Estonia." And wow. I was like, only on the condition that it gets that title in Estonian.
That's hysterical.
Love to purchase a replacement. Who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't, right?
So did you have that title in mind from the very beginning? I know there's one point in the novel where it says he had gotten this replacement life. Was it kind of like an aha moment, or from the very beginning where you're like, yeah?
Yeah, we talked about endings earlier at this roundtable. The ending on both occasions has come in an aha moment, and the titles have come in aha moments. Uh-huh. The body has taken forever, but those particular things have come in flashes. And if it continues to feel as right and as it does in that moment, you hold on to it. But we see so many bland titles. There's a strange convention in book naming. It's like The Fishmonger's Wife and The Police Detective's Nephew and like all these possessive titles. Mm. It's such an overtired convention, I feel like. This is possibly going to be the one thing, in addition to the cover, that your book is evaluated on at the bookstore by someone who doesn't know that much about it yet. Mm-hmm. Make it stand out. Don't make it false. But there are many ways to make it both true and memorable. Mm-hmm. And so that was a criterion as well for me.
Oh, that's good. Was the process easier writing the second novel?
Yes.
How did it change? I mean,
It was just much smoother. Mm-hmm. It took four drafts instead of 12, and 2, 3, and 4 were minor. I got most of it down. Part of the reason that I think it happened that well was because I'd gotten my practice with the first one, but I also planned far less with the second one. I knew the major characters, I knew the basics of the story, I knew nothing beyond that. I knew how it would begin and I knew how it would end. That's it.
And amazingly, you had more or less finished a draft by the time A Replacement Life was published.
Yes, which was, in retrospect, so, so fortunate, because there's been so much less time since this novel has come out. But Harper purchased this novel in January 2013, but didn't publish it until June 2014. But they gave me a contract, and finally I had a little bit of money to not have to do side work for a little while, but the time without distraction to write and write and write, and I used those 18 months to write the second one. I don't need to tell you that since June 2014, when this was published, I've barely written at all.
And what about promotion? I mean, I know most authors don't really get to pick the cover of their book or whatnot, but I think in today's time, like, it's never been more important for the author to sort of self-brand and be active on social media and doing readings, maybe not book tours anymore, but I'm curious about how this was, you know, how was publicity handled and how did you promote your own book?
I would really be curious to hear Henry talk about it because I only have experience with one house. And HarperCollins, the great of it is that they're a corporate behemoth. They have history, they have a lot of practice, they have money, they have all kinds of great things, and I'm also very lucky to have a wonderful editor. What they don't have is a lot of nimbleness in terms of how to adjust well-established processes on how a book gets promoted and the like. And so I found it incredibly useful to supplement as much as I can, because very often I'll come to Harper with an idea and there just isn't the mechanism in place to make that happen, though I'm welcome to try it on my own. Like, for example, I am going to pay Harper to print another round of galleys for the second novel that I'm going to send out, not to reviewers, which they will take care of, but to people in my life whom I'd like to have the book because they might read it, like it, and talk about it. And there are people I'd love to have talk about it. I'm just paying for that out of my pocket, and I can already tell it's very worthwhile. Henry?
I think Harper did an okay job. Better than an okay job.
I think so, yeah.
You know, it would be a rare author who was completely satisfied with his or her publisher's efforts in promoting a book, because after all, it's your book. It's your only book.
You would not knock on every door in America.
Yeah.
You don't understand why your publicist isn't doing that.
Especially with the first novel, it represents a real culmination of a great life's dream for you, and so on and so forth. And you'll lay your life on the line to get people to know about this book. Obviously, for a publisher, it's one of 100 books per season, for the larger publishers, and so forth. And publishing, for the most part, has been somewhat slow to come around to some of the newer mechanisms of publicity and marketing that have developed in the internet age. So increasingly, they do look to authors to be their partner in getting attention for their book. And in Barsi's case, I think they had a superb partner. I mean, as you can tell from listening to Boris tonight, he's a wonderful speaker, incredibly articulate, passionate about his book, and able to communicate that. And that's a publisher's dream, to have a partner like, and you're also incredibly energetic and nicely connected, not in an obnoxious way, but just as a, citizen of the literary community for some time now. So I think you did an amazing job in holding up your end of the promotion deal. And all of this funneled together, and in the week of the book's publication, not only because of the book's quality, but because of some of the efforts that had gone in to make it stand out from the crowd, it got the cover review of the New York Times Book Review, which is any first novelist's most fantastical dream to achieve. So, I'd say all in all, it went pretty well, but, in no small part because of the efforts and the energy and the sweat equity and creativity that you put into promoting it. But look, authors, like anything else in life, come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and some authors are natural self-promoters. For others, it's the most anathema thing to their personality and temperament that you can imagine. And I always say to an author, you push yourself to the edge of your comfort level, not beyond that, but this is your opportunity to do everything you can to try to make your book stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, if you've got a sweat quotient, just spend it all on the first one. I killed myself for the first book. I left no stone unturned. Yeah. I never said no to anyone. I was in living rooms. I was on Skype. I was in book clubs. I was in big venues. I was in small venues. Yeah. I was in Cedar Rapids. I was in Orlando. I was in Rochester. I flew myself out. Sometimes they flew me out. Just, wow. I did nothing but this for a year, and it made a difference. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And one quick thing I want to say about covers, which you asked about, was that neither of my novels had a first cover that I believed represented the novel accurately. Huh. And part of the reason that I try my best to be as good a citizen as possible with HarperCollins is because when cover time rolls around, I'm going to have to spend all that capital in order to persuade them to give it another try, which is the very last thing that they want to do, understandably, because it is an involved process. Yeah. But I've been very fortunate to have them grumblingly agree to do that in both cases and come up with something far better, I think, in both.
Right.
And so overall, I think, considering that I'm working with a fairly large publisher and all the advantages that entails financially and otherwise, it's very hard to complain about the role that they've played in the process. They allow me to be myself, and sometimes that means being neurotic, sometimes that means being over-worrying, sometimes that means being reasonable. They dance with me, and that's all I can ask of them. Yeah. I don't know that Terry gets more emails from any of her other authors.
Terry's your publicist?
Terry's my editor. I should have said Jane.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Earlier you said, this is something I want to bring up because there are a lot of writers in the room, that books or writing ought to show people a way forward. And it made me think of my favorite scenes in your novel, which is when Slava is being followed by this 18-year-old. His name is Oleg. And this moment just really shines. It's like right in the middle of the book where this guy is following Slava. He doesn't know why, and then he finally confronts him. And it turns out that this boy has heard about his writing, not boy, teenager, and he kind of wants to do the same thing. And Slava actually sits down. He doesn't get mad. He sits down. He has some food on him. He breaks bread with him. And then he basically gives him a writing lesson. It's just this really beautiful moment in the middle of the book. And it made me think about, I don't know, just something. There are other passages in the book about the children, how it's all up to us now, and sort of like, you know, passing the torch on to the next generation, both in a sort of, you know, in the mindset of it being an emigre book, but also kind of meta in a way with writing. And so I'm curious if you would.
I'm so very gratified to have this brought up, because it was brought up in this roundtable conversation that we had earlier. And believe it or not, in something like 100 events, it's almost never been brought up. And it's a kind of quote-unquote throwaway scene, because the character never shows up again, and there's no sort of, he's not central to the story. And actually, I think Elena encouraged me, this is the British editor, to get rid of it, and I kept it in anyway, because it just felt like it needed to be there. Partly because most things in the novel should somehow reconcile, even if they just stop rather than resolve. But not everything in a novel, that's the beauty of a novel. Novels can have some loose ends, and it felt very important for me to include this scene, because I'll explain to you, I shared this story earlier, forgive me those of you who've heard it already. I did one of these, I did a reading in a living room in New Jersey, where after I was done, one of the people in attendance came up to me, a young mother, and she said, "My son is 13 years old and has read everything that's ever been written by Shakespeare, and has been writing his own novel since the age of 7 or whatever, and cannot wait to be old enough to go to college and become a writing major and whatever goes on after that. Please tell me how to stop him."
My mom said that before I went into an MFA program as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is exclusive to the community that I come from. This was a Russian Jewish gathering. I come out of a community where sort of there's a great amount of reverence for art, as long as it's not your own that goes into it. Mm-hmm. And I did my best with her, but sort of Oleg is at a crossroads. He's trying to spread his wings, and his family is doing its best to beat them down. And I had less mentorship than I wanted as a young journalist coming up. Publishing is a lot better with that. Just the very fact that the institution of agenting is in a way an institution of mentorship. Nothing like that exists in journalism, and I was really lost. And I'm not the world's greatest journalist, but that is the career that I wanted to make first, and I will never make a career in that field, because it showed no interest in my skills such as they were whatsoever. And so it is just so, it is never practical to take time out and work with someone who is junior to you rather than senior to you, but wants to go along the same path. There's just a great nobility to that, because you are investing in the future. I don't encourage all of my students to keep writing, but those that should, I beat down their door insisting that they don't give up and they don't stop after the class is over. I've got a kid in my class right now who's ROTC. I mean, a fiction career is the very last thing that he's thinking about. But I'm going to have some conversations with him after the class is over to at least plant that seed in his head, in case there's that moment when he's 26 and casting about and trying to figure out what to do because X hasn't worked out, how I would love to be the voice that comes up in his head then. And if he writes me then, I will find time to engage with him, even though there's no practical value to it.
Well, I felt that was a point in the novel as well, where Slava's kind of realizing his influence and maybe...
And responsibility.
Yeah. Well, let's take some questions from the audience. I think this is a good time. Go ahead and just raise your hand if you have any. And Kate and Cade, get ready with your microphones. Okay, I see one right here in the middle.
Does HarperCollins do any e-publishing, or do you have the right to have this book e-published by somebody?
It has been e-published.
All
of the major publishers, when they buy a book now, buy not only the print edition rights, but also the ebook rights. It's almost impossible to sell a book to a major publisher without including the ebook rights.
Yeah. Actually, I was just going to interrupt real quick for a second to say I listened to your book both as audiobook and I read it. And I don't know who the voice actor is, but did an excellent job. So I would encourage
you to
listen.
It's the guy from Scandal.
Gosh, it was good. He nails all the accents, and I mean, I thought so at least. It was really great.
W.H. Mason?
No. Or maybe I'm misremembering the show. It's what's his name? He was also in Father of the Bride. I'm blanking on his name. He's a British guy.
Yeah.
With your second novel, you earned the right to read it yourself, and so I'm going to read the second novel. It's just about to happen next month.
Awesome. I think I saw another question. Yeah.
Okay, so I know this is a hard question, but like I feel like your characters often talk about truth versus fiction. So I was wondering where you would draw the line between nonfiction and fiction.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
We could honestly spend a semester on that.
You know,
I hereby invite VCU to invite me to teach a class on the borderland between fiction and nonfiction. Oh, there's so much that could be said about that. Please jump in if either of you have something to say. There's this idea today that, you know, pure fact is impossible. Even what you're reading in the New York Times isn't entirely fact, if only because it's being written by an individual with a subjective viewpoint. And actually, this strange convention of not including the personal pronoun in Times reportage has always rubbed me the wrong way, because it actually conceals the fact that this is being presented to you from a particular viewpoint. There's 10 different ways to write that story. You know, we get biographies that are supposed to be non-fictional, but so much of that is reconstructed. Has anyone here read Patrimony by Philip Roth?
Yes.
It's technically a memoir, though God knows how much of it had to be reconstructed and invented. But it is finer than any of his novels, because it uses so many of the tools of fiction in order to tell a story that was ultimately factual. It's a memoir of his father dying. And meanwhile, as we see with a book like this, so much fiction is grounded in things that really happened. And so the best thing that I can say without going on for an hour is that the borderline is so very porous. But for some reason, so many of us in so many different ways want to live in a world that sees the border as far clearer than that, and it just isn't. And so I would just exhort all of you when reading nonfiction to think about all of it that is, how much of it didn't necessarily happen that way, and when reading fiction to realize how much of it possibly did. It's a really porous border.
Yeah. I see you right up here in the front.
So this is kind of maybe a little bit of a basic question, but when you're going through the actual writing process, most of the writers I know tend to have like this weird mix of like low self-esteem, but also narcissism. So,
totally.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask, like, whenever you're going through the process of actually making, like, the choices, like, do I keep this? Is this concept solid? Is the execution a little bit shaky? Should I alter it? Should I omit it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do you operate between the voice in your head that hates everything you do, the voice in your head that thinks that you're a secret genius, and the voice outside of your head that tells you to get rid of half of your novel?
I have Henry to tell me when I need to get rid of half of it. I referred to a healthy arrogance before. Look, the more you read and the more you write, you develop a sense of things. And so you know when you've produced a good line, or you know when you've produced an insight that's valuable. You know when you've done a scene. It's especially wonderful when something doesn't go the way that you planned, but it feels true. All of a sudden, the character has revealed themselves differently than you planned, but in a more truer way than what you planned originally. You just know that's good, and you're an idiot to waste any time thinking, is this worthy, is this worthy? Let somebody else worry about that. I'm talking about something very abstract, I realize, because I'm talking about instinct. But if you've developed enough of an instinct through reading and through writing to be able to spot that, you would be betraying yourself to doubt yourself at that moment. I think all writers operate with such an enormous sense of self-doubt that you should never worry about being too much of too kind to yourself. I mean, no one is harder on my work than I am before I let anyone see it. At the same time, there's something so ugly about narcissism and secretly thinking that you're a genius. I don't know really who can proceed too far with that kind of notion of oneself, considering the pleasure the world takes in saying no to you over and over. If you manage to preserve that sense of yourself despite that, then I have things to learn from those people. But I try to waste no time on narcissism, but equally little on low self-esteem. Neither is helpful. There's this idea that suffering leads to great art, and one of the few conservative things that Norman Mailer said was, well, actually, that's not true. He was a fairly conservative fellow in other ways. But what I mean is that one of the fairly non-self-destructive things that Norman Mailer said was that it is nothing is more important to the writer than to be healthy, to have slept well, to have energy, and something as plain as that. And it's equally important to be mentally sound. Take care of yourself, bodily and mentally, in order to be able to give well to your work. And this recalls another line by Flaubert, be a bourgeois in your life so you can be a madman in your art. I go to bed at 10 o'clock if I can, because I'd like to get up early and write. That is more exciting than any bar I can go to.
Is that your system? Do you write every morning?
Well, I've struggled to find the time since this novel's come out for the most wonderful reasons, but on an ideal day, I'll be up by 8 o'clock, reading by 8:30, writing by 10, and finishing up by 2 or 3. If I've done that, it's been a great day. And ideally, one does that Monday through Friday and ends up with a draft by the end of the year.
You start the day reading other novels?
Yeah, you know, when I read others before writing, when I was just starting out, it messed with my prose. Mm-hmm. But I've now gotten to a point where it inspires me rather than impedes me. And I'll just read someone to just get jazzed about what words can do. And I'm just hopped up on it. It's like a fix, you know? It's like a drug that you take in order to get right with your work. And you just toss the book away, ideally, and sit down and get cracking. And ideally, it's a really energetic experience. And you know, you learn which writers help you in what way. Like Nadine Gordimer is very hard for me to finish a novel by, but no one is better at just making me realize everything that words and close observation can do.
Some more? Raise it real high.
Thank you. Boris, I haven't read your book, but I'm looking forward to doing so, especially when you mentioned Bill Styron, and which is one of my favorite guys. I think he took over from Faulkner. Every time I read him, and I'm sure this is a bad comment on me, I have to have a dictionary with Styron. And then I say, that's the right word. Mm-hmm. But here's a business thing. This is on the business side of your trade. Did you negotiate a two-book deal, or did it just so happen that after the first one, they were quick to say, if you got another one, we'll sign you? Or do you have is that the way it works?
I'll let Henry answer that one because you know the details better than I do. But it wasn't a two-book deal.
No, it was a one-book deal, and the timing worked out happily such that your new novel, "Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo," was ready to show your publisher at the exact moment that Times Review came out. So that was fortuitous.
Definitely.
But separate one-book deals.
Yeah.
Over here.
So as someone who's spent a lot of time on beginnings and maybe, you know, shorter stories but has never, you know, gotten to the end of a novel, I'm curious to hear you talk about what it's like to be bringing things full circle and, like, get to the end. Because, I don't know, I imagine it must be a different place, but I've never been there. So I'm just curious to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier, too. This for me was very instructive. I started writing fiction late. I was 30 by the time that I began. Or close to it, and I was desperate. I was a second career. The first one had not been particularly lucrative, and I jumped from the frying pan into the fire by going from journalism into fiction. I was desperate for some kind of referendum on whether I had it. I had what it takes, and I got through about 150 pages of the first draft of this novel, and I had an agent who was willing to look at what I was doing. I was sort of cheating on the agent that I had at the time, because I knew that wasn't going to go anywhere. And I sent it off to her, and she wrote back very quickly, and she said, you have no idea what this novel is about, and you won't know until you finished it. And then when you finish the draft, then you'll finally understand what you had been meaning to do all along, at which point you'll need to go back to the beginning and then write what you intended. When you get to the end of draft two, give me a call. And what I mean to say by that is that the value of finishing a short story, 3,000 words, 5,000 words, whatever it is 10 times the value of writing a beautiful paragraph. Make it ugly. Make it, as a friend of mine says, write the most boring story you can, but get to the end. Some of us are so daunted by the challenge of writing the best story that's ever been written, we travel away from what our native strengths and instincts are. Try to write the most boring story you can. Try to bore the hell out of whoever's going to read it. you're going to surprise yourself. But whatever you do, get to the end. Write 500 words a day for 2 weeks. You will have a story at the end of it. Waste no time worrying about how crappy what happened before was. Even if you realize, oh, I should have done something differently 2 pages ago because of where I am now, leave that till later. Just go, 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 go. The value of finishing is immeasurable.
I see another one in the middle there.
I'm just dying to know, is your mother still talking to you?
I only empathize with my mother because she did not ask to be, they're very proud, but she did not ask to be brought into the spotlight in this way. And by this way, I mean there are no saints out there, or at the very least, or there are. My mother is pretty close to it, but that's not what makes a character interesting. It's what makes a person wonderful, but it's not what makes a character interesting. You want the warts in there. She is proud, but taken aback by what exactly this all has meant.
Well, thank you both so much. This
we
has
do
been
one more.
Oh, we have another one
in the corner there.
Okay, well, let's
that,
have one more
make
question.
That the last one.
Yeah.
Winner's prerogative.
Hi, my question is, when you were going to create this novel, was it more like you wanted to do it, or did you feel like a sense of obligation to like finish it or to like get this out, get this like feeling out of?
That's a great question because I tried everything I could to do something else. I mean, I interned in a law firm. I was accepted by the Foreign Service. I was a hiking guide. I was a market researcher for a maker of temporary concrete.
I'm seeing you wow. in each of these costumes
right?
as you put them off.
I had a family that would have loved for me to do just about anything else. I was someone who would have, get this, I got a job as editorial director of a tech startup where my job was to travel the world on their dime and write about the hotels that I stayed in.
Oh my gosh.
And they gave me 6 figures for it. And I had the audacity to be miserable while doing this. And so at a certain point you just say, you know what you say, but then you also say, if I'm going to be impoverished, I might as well be impoverished on behalf of something I really love. Like if I'm going to be miserable, at least let me be miserable doing something I love. And so it would not go away. And how grateful I am. I was on the verge of receiving a pretty strong offer from a PR firm when I got a phone call from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is a writing residency on the edge of Cape Cod, where you go for 7 months. They take 5 fiction writers per session out of the hundreds that apply, and I was number 6. And then somebody's mother had passed away, God forbid. But what that meant was that they could no longer attend, and now the invitation was mine. That phone call came a day before I accepted that job wow. offer. And when I went off to be miserable for 7 months in the Cape Cod winter, where I also banged out the first draft of the novel. I would have been miserable in a wholly different way were I to take on that PR job. Not because there's anything wrong with PR, it was just the wrong fit for me. And how grateful I am that that phone call came through when it did. And I do wonder a lot what would have happened if I had to. You know what? I probably would have quit that job 3 months later and found a way. It won't quit. And if it won't quit, please don't kill it. Respond to it.
So, Boris and Henry will be around to talk, and Boris is going to be signing his books in the back. Thank you so much for this. This was great.
Thank you, Chad.
Thanks,
and congratulations.
And thank you all for coming.
And Boris's next book comes out, when is the pub date for that?
March 1st.
March 1st is his second novel.